All right, welcome back to the Mediocre Alaska Podcast. My guest today is Paul Atkins. Paul Atkins is a teacher, writer, and author of Atkins's Alaska. The book came out this spring and is available online. You can also go to his Facebook, Instagram, all that, and order directly from him. And I'm assuming get autographed copies. Is that right?
That is correct.
Outstanding. Well, thanks for being on here, man.
Yeah, it's good to be here. It's good to finally hook up, man. We've been trying to do this for what?
Yeah.
Forever.
Yeah. In the interest of full disclosure, we had a podcast planned in early June, and I thought I got to
see. Is that when it was?
That's what it was, because it was a couple weeks before my wedding, and I thought,
yep.
You know, I can squeeze this in, but that was a bad idea.
It was a bad plan.
Squeeze things in, but so we were going to talk today, and then something came up, and your air and heat unit went out, which is kind of a lower 48 problem. You're down there in Oklahoma currently.
Yeah.
But you've lived in above the Arctic Circle for the last 30 years. So what was kind of what's the standard concern for living there as far as your home and what might fail? And then what's the most unique, oh my gosh, I hope this doesn't fail, in your home in Alaska?
Well, the thing that I was worried about the most failed last night. So it's like 103 here, man. I tell you, it's crazy. You know, you asked me earlier what I was up to. I said, well, I'm hot and I'm tired and it's different. And it definitely is a different world down here. But, you know, I grew up here. Went to school here, did the whole nine yards here, and then before I went north, and you think I'd be used to this stuff, but after being gone 30 years and living up there, it's like, oh my gosh, it's crazy. But yeah, the heating and air is a big issue. Forest fires are a big issue. Getting a hay bale for the cows is a big issue. Lots of different issues.
Mm-hmm. What was kind of your, like in the winter, up north, what was your, like, I'm sure you had to become pretty good at repairing things. Was there anything specific in the last 30 years that, like, this went out and you had to go a week without heat or something like that, or pipes for
you? Yeah, we had a lot of that up there. We did. We really did. We, you know, boilers and, well, you know, heating oil and most of the heating up there was through, you know, water running through the pipes. Warm, you know, heat the water, run through the pipes, glycol, the whole nine yards. And, you know, that was the biggest worry, was that your boiler would go out. And if that happened, you know, you'd hopefully had somebody on speed dial that you could call and they'd come fix it that night. Otherwise, there was a few nights that our boiler went out that, you know, we didn't have anybody and it got darn cold. You know, it got really cold some of those winters. And usually it was in the dead of the winter, and usually it was in January for some reason. same way with snow machines and the same way with cars and four-wheelers and the whole thing. It seemed like January was just this. I mean, I hated January up there because it was dark, for one thing. And secondly, you know, there was no hunting and there was really no fishing yet, no ice fishing yet. So you're like, you know, I think the Ides of, you know, the movie, or maybe it's a book, The Ides of March. This was like The Ides of January. So I'm like, geez. So, but you know, it's two different worlds. And then I've told somebody the other day that, you know, moving back, you know, I've been up there 30 years and I did my time and it was glorious. It was the greatest adventure of my life. But coming down here is like living on a different planet. It's like I moved to a different planet.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
That first winter that you were up there, was it every bit as shocking as you thought it would be?
You know, I was kind of nursed a little bit in the beginning, because the first time I ever went, other than the fall time when I went up there back in the early 90s and hunting with my uncles and stuff, the first winter I went up there was, I actually went in March. So I was only there for a couple weeks. And you know how March is in the Arctic and in Alaska in general. Up there, it's, you know, 18, 19 hours of sunlight. It's beautiful. It's not that cold. Ice fishing's good. We still had a late subsistence moose season. So you could do all those things. So I thought, man, this is glorious. This is as bad as it gets. But that first winter, yeah, it was, it was pretty mind-boggling, especially, you know, it rolls around about end of November, it's getting darker, 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 and then I think, you know, that first winter it was 50, 60 below zero. It was crazy.
Yeah. You were in Kotzebue, so, right?
Yeah, I've always been in Kotzebue the whole ride.
The sense of community in Alaska is something that, at least in the small communities, I'm assuming it's prevalent everywhere, but definitely in the small communities for sure. Did you feel that you were welcomed from the beginning? I felt that my family was very well. I moved to Alaska when I was five, so my parents felt very welcomed. And there are some people who don't really like outsiders, and because we weren't born there, you know, we weren't really totally local. But by and large, people were so accepting and so helpful right off the bat because they were either the new person or they wanted to welcome someone who's going to bring value to the community. So can you talk a little bit about how strong that community is because you're all enduring that nasty winter?
Yeah, you know, I'm lucky, and I'll count myself lucky because, you know, I had people and I had relatives there. You know, my aunt and uncle were there. That's kind of why the reason I went was all those years ago was, you know, my uncle was a retired firefighter from Oklahoma, and my aunt got a teaching degree and she wanted to start a career. He said, "Where do you want to go?" And she said, "Let's go to Alaska." And they kind of just closed their eyes and pointed and got Kotzebue, you know, came up. And then my dad, he's a hunter, and he went early, like in the late 80s. And, you know, I was still in college in those days, but they were there for many years. And then I started going, and I think, you know, I was lucky in that standpoint. I got accepted as being part of their family, and they were very well accepted because she was a great teacher and he worked in the cafeteria, so they knew everybody. And as far as the community goes, yeah, it's you know, the best way I can put it is when we left, when we retired, you know, a couple months ago or whenever that was, May, I guess, it was super sad for us, and it was super sad for the community because we were so well accepted. And you know, it's a huge, it's our family. We kind of left our family up there, but no, it's pretty strong. You know, Kotzebue and most of the small towns, villages in Alaska, you know, you come in, you do some good things and you care about the community and you invest in the community, you know, it pays off. And, you know, we've always, you know, I miss it so bad right now, so I'm about to go crazy.
Yeah. That's the biggest thing when you go into a community, and what are you providing for the community? I think a lot of people get in a take sort of mindset, especially when they come to Alaska for like for the resources. I'm going up here and I come up every summer and I hunt this and I do this, and it's just kind of that take, where if you're providing something to the overall well-being of it, it becomes a really nice place, and you think that you could live there.
Right. You know, I don't know. In my book, I wrote a story about when I did first come, and I don't know if you got to read it or not, Jeff, but about the when this is like early in the early days, like a couple years in, maybe a year in, maybe after residency, you know, a couple years in, there a guy wrote a newspaper article about all the young teachers in Alaska. They just come to Alaska and they just want to hunt and fish, get the residency, blah blah blah. And he really slammed us pretty hard. He pointed me out as in specifically. And years later, I kind of laugh at that because, you know, it's, hey, you know, you invest your whole life into those kids and that community and the school and whatever you do. And I've always found that to be quite the chuckle after the fact, I guess. But, you know, it's that's the way some people see it, I guess. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, you can't please everybody. Yeah, it's just going to happen.
Yeah.
So Kotzebue has, what, 3,000 people?
Yeah, you know, it used to be when we first got there, it was about 3,500, but it's dwindled. It dwindled down into the low 2,000, not the low 2,000, like 2,800, 2,900. But from what I understand, it's kind of on the rebound. So, yeah, about that, about 3,000.
So, and it is kind of a regional hub. It's hard to, you know, for people maybe who are listening from down south, think a town of 3,000 people is a hub. But are some of the people from that area moving to the nearest big city like Kotzebue because there's more opportunity?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, Kotzebue's the hub, and then there's, what, 10 villages on the outside, something like that, spread out kind of like a fan, if people are listening and want to know kind of what it looks like. Kotzebue's kind of there at where the Kobuk and the Noatak Rivers meets, kind of you know, Sisolik, which is right across the sound, is where they used to have all the trading fairs back in the old days amongst the Inuits. But yeah, it's they're moving to Kotzebue for more opportunities, but there's a lot of opportunities in some of the villages too, especially with construction. Over that's what I've seen over the years anyway, is because, you know, every village has a new school that's been built, and you know, there's that too. But I see a lot of people heading, you know, south too, you know, Palmer, Wasilla, down in that part of the world as well. But yeah, a little bit.
When I grew up in Klawak, and my graduating class had 16 kids in it, and mm-hmm. the high school itself had 65, 68, something like that. But now the entire school, K-12, has like 112.
Oh,
which
really?
Which is crazy. And Prince of Wales Island has some other communities, but a lot of these smaller communities are kind of drying up. And, you know, you have certain resources. You know, the logging isn't what it was. Mm-hmm. You just don't have the same. You know, the economy isn't as good. So it's kind of scary to think about some of these smaller communities going forward and what's going to be there for the community. And then that next generation of kid who grows up there, if they don't get out, what are they going to do? And if is there going to be anything to come back to if they want to come back? You know, what's the
right?
You can probably come back and be a teacher, but you know, as far as business and things like that, and you know, maybe there can be some construction jobs, stuff like that. But are you kind of concerned for?
Yeah, I am. You know, but I am. I am concerned for rural Alaska. It's you know, a lot of that's one of the biggest things. When I did my exit interview, we kind of got interviewed by some people about our time there and everything. And one of the biggest things that I wanted to see is I'd like to see more of the Native kids going and getting teaching degrees and come back and teaching teaching school there. I mean, and we're starting, and the cool thing about that is we're starting to see a little bit of that that's happened. I know a couple of students that I had in class back in the old days, they're teaching now at Kotzebue Elementary at JNES, and that's just great things to see. But yeah, I'm concerned about that. I've always been concerned about kids getting, you know, I don't like to say the word getting out, but getting out and then hopefully maybe coming back in. I don't know. It's scary at times, but you know, my son just graduated from Kotzebue. I mean, he's Alaskan. I'm not Alaskan. He's an Alaskan. And he can always say he's an Alaskan and he's a Kotzebue kid through and through. And you know, the school did great for him. And you know, he had 40, I think, he ended up with 34 in his graduating class, which that scares me a little bit, because the classes, even, you know, I taught middle school, eighth grade, and a little bit of high school all the years that I was there. And, you know, some of those classes are at like 60, 65 when we get them. And by the time they get, you know, to high school, graduate, the classes are half that. You know, the graduating class is usually half that. And I know it has a lot to do with, you know, some move, some transfer, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, that's always concerned me a great deal, so.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing with like the getting out is the idea of seeing the world. And I think some people think that, oh, get out, leave, because this place is terrible. It's got nothing for you. That's not necessarily.
Right. It's not the case.
So, and if you do want to come back on your own terms. Like,
right.
Go out, get a teaching degree, or, you know, be able to come back and run a business that provides value to the community. So
yeah.
you can come home rather than just never leave. Which, and some people stick around, you know, Southeast Alaska has opportunities for a kid. I got former students who were charter
yep.
fishermen, commercial fishermen, and that's great. Mm-hmm. They're happy and there's nothing at all wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with that.
But, yeah, it is. It's an interesting thing going
on. You know,
forward.
It's, and there's, you know, up there for the kids, there's lots of good jobs. I mean, one of my oldest friends up there, I had all of his kids in class, and he, you know, he works and he never went to college, but he stayed and he made a life for himself. And he is a phenomenal guy. He's a great hunter. He's a great fisherman. He's got a great job and he provides, and it's a good life for him. And he always tells me that. He goes, you know, I didn't go to college, but I came back and this is what I do. And I'm thinking, man, he's a good role model for those kids. And there's a lot of opportunity. There's a lot of opportunity. I know in Kotzebue, there's a lot of opportunity still. I mean, we've got lots of construction going on. They're building a new airport up there, you know. So, and new roads, and it's crazy busy up there from what I understand. So
that new airport is obviously going to be used by locals, but how much increase in traffic have you seen from hunters over the last 30 years?
Oh yeah, September's packed. I've seen a lot. It's kind of weird. Back in the early days, it was kind of a free for all, Back when moose tags we could buy bought over the counter. Caribou was what, five a day? Two, well, maybe not for non-residents or non-locals, but it was, just get two or three tags and the moose tag and you go have a heck of a time. And it was big time. You seen a lot of airplanes and a lot of guides and a lot of outfitters and things of that nature. And everybody, all my friends wanted to come and most of them did. And we did the thing. If you read my book, you'll see a lot of that. But I think with changes in populations of game animals, fishing game, they regulate that pretty closely, and so does the subsistence boards, which that's a whole nother ball of wax there.
Yeah.
But it's always been pretty constant. Here lately, though, the last few years, I haven't seen as much traffic. COVID kind of killed everybody the last, I mean, I shouldn't say that word. They knocked everybody back the last couple of years. And it's been, it's been pretty, but from what I understand now, I've talked to some guys up there and they say it's back to business. So, used to be we'd have, six, seven, eight outfitters up there with airplanes and they were booked solid and, tags were unlimited. Everybody had 60, 70, 80 clients and it was, but that's when we had 600,000 head of caribou too. So.
Yeah. I don't really, I've never been up there and I haven't hunted that, but I heard about the attempt to close, and it's still an ongoing attempt to close that to non federally qualified. As someone who's there, obviously it's a huge mixed bag. Like there's no clear right and wrong answer. Do you think if it were to be closed down to non federally qualified hunters that it would have an economic impact on Kotzebue?
I don't think so. I don't, I mean, I've been asked this question so many times in the last, I don't know, every, it comes up every time, Jeff. It comes up every 4 or 5 years, the same thing. I've seen it happen so many times. I've in the early days I used to go to those meetings and this group wants to close it from this group and blah 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 blah. To be honest with you, it just comes and goes. If they closed it, here's my 2 cents, and I haven't given it. This will be the first time I've ever even mentioned it. It's federal land. It belongs to everybody. The state can do what they want to do. And I know the caribou numbers are lower. They are. But I wrote a story about this one time and I did some research on it that, back in the 70s it got down to 70,000 head. Now we're at what? Quarter mil? But I've seen it as much as almost 700,000. So it just fluctuates. But I think, if it's federal land, it's federal land. It belongs to all of us. And too, I guess, but with regulations. But I don't see it as being a huge impact on, I don't see it being a huge impact on Kotzebue itself, because most, and I may be wrong here, so somebody will probably call me on it, but most of the income that comes into Kotzebue from outside, outfitters, guides, that kind of thing, there's not much. There really isn't, because a lot of those guys bring their own stuff in. When they take these camps out and stuff, and most guys, most of those hunts are do it yourself. So really, the only they're buying is just a plane ride, or a boat ride, and so I don't see it impacting Kotzebue that much. But as far as the herd goes, I don't think people understand they never bought meat in Kotzebue. Okay, all right. So or milk or anything else or gas as far as that goes. So yeah, I think the subsistence hunter, the people that live up there, they should get a little more. A lot of people say, well, five caribou a day, that's just too many, that's crazy. I've never killed five caribou a day, okay? In all my years. If I take one or two a year, I'm happy camper. That fills my freezer, feeds my family. But a lot of those families, they got big families and they go have a couple of guys go out and do their thing and it provides. But as far as non-residents and non-locals hunting, I don't see that affecting the herd that much. I think I did. I read a study on it that non-residents and people who don't live there maybe take 1,200 a year. which is, you know, in my opinion, that's just a drop in the bucket compared to.
Yeah.
But, you know, it'll bounce back one day and it'll be good. And then in 3 or 4 years, we'll see the same thing come up. Promise you that. I promise you that.
Yeah. A buddy of mine lived in Barrow, and I asked him kind of naively, because I look at the regulations and, you know, 6 caribou per day or whatever. I was like, man, that's a lot of caribou per day. And he's like, well, it's 6 caribou per day just in case the herd happens to be there. But you're not going out on
right.
a snow machine going 200 miles on a weekend to shoot 6 caribou. That's too much right. work. That's too much gas. It's too much whatever. And just the massive expanse of land. So I think sometimes people will look at those regulations and say that it's unsustainable. But the sheer amount of land and work it would be to try to track down the herd, find it, and take those numbers, it's mm-hmm. not going to happen. But it does allow when the herd is around to be able to get the food that you need. So if it is around, you're doing most of that within a couple of weeks to be able to feed your family for the year, rather than 6 per day times family. That's, you know, hundreds and hundreds per family. That's not happening.
Right. It's not. I mean, really, you're not. And, you know, it's an opportunity thing. I mean, it's always been an opportunity thing. I've been out, you know, I don't have to be honest with you. I haven't shot a caribou in the fall and a while, probably the last 3 or 4 years. And, you know, that's another thing. The herds, some of the herds are, and that's another thing that they blame. You know, it's a blame game a little bit. The outfitters and the plains are moving, pushing the caribou further east, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I'd last 2 years ago, I think we started seeing them trickle back down the Noatak, which is one of the major rivers up there. So they're coming back around and, you know, but yeah, it's an opportunity thing. You know, I've been in camp when they're running through camp and I've been in camp and I didn't see one for a week. So, you know, but those guys, the guys that, you know, that, and a lot of people that they don't understand that a lot of people that he and Hall about 5 caribou a day or 6 caribou a day, they don't live up there. They don't understand how it works. And, you know, it's just one of them deals.
Yeah. I like the idea of providing the locals, the people who live there, right? The people who have 30 Januaries under their belt rather than, you know, 15 week-long trips in September that they paid for. You know, the mm-hmm. people who live there, giving them first shot, but like some sort of compromise. If you are going to dial stuff back on Prince of Wales Island, if you're federally qualified, you can get your 4 deer and you get an extra week to hunt. If you're non-federally qualified, you got to wait until, you have to wait 2 weeks. So you can still hunt. You can get 2 rather than 4, but there's still an opportunity rather than just, you know, shutting it down. So hopefully these things right. can end in some sort of compromise that allows, you know, people to come up and have that, you know, trip of a lifetime, experience of a lifetime. The outfitters can make their living.
Yep. Yep. But, I'm all about that. I mean, really, I'm all about that too. I feel exactly the same way because, you know, a lot of those outfitters and guides and people are my friends that, and I've hunted with them many times and I've hired them to take me out. And they got to make a living too. And I think the end, the word compromise, I think that's the key to success on both sides, all sides, and, you know, making it sustainable for future generations, which really, bottom line, that's kind of what it's about anyway.
Yeah. So when you decide to write a book, how much, like, I don't want to say censoring, but how much did you consider what you should write versus maybe what you shouldn't write? And was there a filter that you engaged when it came to telling your stories about living up there?
Yeah, I think so. When I left, I'm actually sitting out on my front porch for those that are listening, and it's 100 degrees out here. But I don't know if you guys can hear the cicadas over the phone, but yeah, I'm looking at my target, my archery range is out here in front of me as well, which is kind of fun, by the way. Anyway, when I left here back in a long time ago, I told my dad before I left, I said, I'm going to write a book. And he kind of hee-hawed, you won't be there that long.
Well,
I'm still going to write a book. Okay. And I only planned to be here for a couple, there, I could say here, I'm still thinking I'm in Kotzebue, but I was only going to be there for a couple years. But, you know, it turned into 23 plus all those other years I showed up. But, you know, and then I had started writing back in the early 90s. I'd done a lot of whitetail hunting down here in Kansas and I wrote a couple stories and they were pretty good and they got published. And I was like, you know, oh my gosh, that's awesome. I'm glad I got done that and never probably do it again. And we got to Alaska and then I'm like, I'm doing this stuff every single day. I mean, every day in Alaska, you're hunting, fishing, thinking about hunting and fishing, and you're usually going somewhere. That's the thing I've always felt about like northern Alaska versus maybe middle Alaska and then down where you're at, southern Alaska. Southern Alaska, you guys do a lot of the same stuff that northern Alaska does. We can go out just about any time we want, fishing, hunting, doing something, right? Whereas in the middle of Alaska, you kind of got to do the tag thing, you got to get drawn thing, you got to get the city part in my book. But anyway, up there in the Arctic, you can hunt 365. You can take, like we were talking about, 5 caribou a day. But I was doing all these things, and I thought, you know, I should start writing this stuff down. So I did. And, you know, I think I published my 400th article the other day.
Yeah, I saw the post. Congratulations.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
I mean, it's thanks. But, you know, so I had all of this stuff, and I thought, well, it's time. Let's put some of it together. So I had all of this stuff to choose from. And yeah, there's some stories I probably wouldn't want to put in the book. Some were, you know, I mean, I don't know if I'm not saying they were bad or they were bad, but you know, some stories are, you write a story, you know how it is. You're a writer. Some stories are great. And you know, a great story when you start writing it and then you see it at the end product, you know, it's great. But you know, a lot of them were just, you know, they were just stories that, you know, you got published. But no, I just gathered up everything that I thought was good and kind of had, you know, I don't know if they had a moral or not, but they had sure had a story, you know. So I don't know, probably not as much as most people think.
There's one of the things that I encountered that was difficult was being able to try to convey a story. Because anytime you're telling a hunting story, fishing story, any sort of story, you're telling a story that no one else was there for. So how do you make it, how do you involve the reader and not make it sound like an inside story or like you had to be there type thing?
There's like somebody things, had to be, yeah like just, somebody had to be there to know what was going on.
It's so hard.
It is hard. It's so hard to do. And I think, and this is how I approached it all those years, is I've always tried to, that first paragraph, you know, and this is just writing 101, is, you know, you got to hook them. You got to get that hook in and you got to create that interest. And I think, I don't know, trying to use your, make sure that your writing is filled with, I don't want to sound so cliche, you know, use lots of adjectives, that kind of thing. It was so cold, you know, but you know, try to make them, and it's hard to do. I understand totally what you're saying, because a lot of people in those early days, they would read my stuff and go, huh? You know? And I'm like, okay, like I changed the way I do things. And, you know, tell them exactly what's going on. You know, there was a rock. Tell them about the rock. There was a snow. There was a bluff. There was a grizzly charging dead on at 8 yards. And really describe the best you can and then let them fill in their imagination. I don't know.
I had a buddy from California who I fished with, and he's a English teacher down there, and I sent him a copy of the manuscript to read, and there's this balance of, you want to sound authentic, you want to sound like an Alaskan, but at the same time, you don't want to alienate people by making it so uniquely Alaskan no one gets it. And so I think I used the word corked for just like, you know, you got screwed by something or something bad happened. And so he's like, is corked like local jargon? And I was like, yeah. He said, do you sure you want to use that? I'm like, yeah, I think so. Cause that, you know, you're the Southeast Alaska, or, you know, that's that regional dialect. Like they know that. And so you have to have that sort of authenticity, so you don't sound like someone who just came up once and wrote about it, because that excitement comes through because they've never done it before and it's all new and fresh, but someone who's done it before, it's different.
But yeah, you're right. You're exactly right.
As you were going through this, and there's so much difference between writing a magazine article, a column, something like that, and then writing a book, were there times where you just thought, you know, you're 134 pages in, you're like, this sucks. This isn't good enough. It's too much work. Like, how often do you have to fight that voice?
Oh, I fought it a lot. I really did. I mean, I thought, And I, you know, I kind of procrastinated forever on it. I had it on my laptop, and I had this file that said book. I wrote the introduction.
You didn't even but name here, it?
Now this is no, I didn't name it. I just put book. But I had wrote, and I had wrote, and this is going to sound really weird to people. I wrote the introduction many years ago. If you get the book and you read it, and you read the introduction, I wrote that probably, I'm going to say 15 years ago, I wrote the introduction. And I knew in my mind how the end would be. And then that's going to sound weird because it ends on, like, you know, we've gone through COVID, and I think I put a poem in there for the, and I'm no poet. I don't know if you've seen that or not, but I had got those in my mind, and I put them in this folder on my laptop, and I changed laptops like 3 times since then. So it always moved from laptop to laptop. But I had it, and even these days, I go look at some of my old files, and it'll jump up, intro, book intro. But yeah, I got to the point at times that I'm like, well, I'm going to do this. If I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it now. I got to get it done. And so I started putting it together and started, you know, piecing this one. Okay, I like this story to start. Let's write about this. People love down here, you know. I think one thing that helps is all this Alaska crazy. You know, down in the lower 48, they're just goo-goo for Cocoa Puffs over all this stuff that's on TV. I'm serious. I tell people, I said, that's not real, you know. Yeah. But it's fun to watch. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. It is fun to watch. But, you know, it's pretty not real. And I said, I kind of lived in that lifestyle. I kind of know Life Below Zero and some of those other ones. But anyway, I probably changed my mind when I started really seriously working on it. I probably changed my mind 100 times on what I was going to do. And finally, I got to the point. I'll be honest with you. I got to the point where I'm like, okay, I'm done. That's it. Here it is. Take it or leave it. It's yours. Do what you can do with it. But then I'd get it back and I go, I was like obsessive there for about a month. My wife would say, "You come to bed? No, I got to get this done. Got to go through it one more time." I think I had 7 edits when it was all done. So, and it's still not perfect, but I did it. So,
my high school English teacher said, "You're never finished with a piece of writing; you just finally give up." And I think he took that. He probably cited Twain or someone like that. But that's totally true. And one of the reasons that kind of got me to follow through with it was because, like you said, so many people are making so much money off telling fake stories about Alaska.
Yeah.
Or coming up here and making money off their one trip. That I thought, you know what? You know who should tell an Alaska story? Alaskans should tell Alaska story.
And I agree. I think
people are like shutting us down or not asking for us. It's just, I'm not sure that Alaskans necessarily like advocate it, or they're so busy actually living the life that they're not necessarily trying to monetize it. And so, you know, you got some people who were doing, you know, some podcasts, you know, Tyler Friel, and he writes for Outside Magazine.
Tyler's,
you got a bunch of people who are starting to crop up now, and it's like, hey, this is our story. Let's tell our story. Let's not let the Discovery Channel poach our story or manufacture it or Hollywoodize it. So it's pretty cool to see, and it's also very cool to connect with, you know, you and I actually talked years ago about grizzly bear hunt,
yeah,
and you said, come on up. There's so many around. I was like, dude, I should.
Yeah.
And I never did.
I know. I would like to. You know, a lot of guys, like Tyler and I, are good friends, and a lot of the guys, and you, and we wrote about the real Alaska. A lot of people ask me that very thing. What's your book about? It's about the real Alaska. Well, what makes it real? I said, read it, and you'll know it's real.
Yeah.
So, but yeah. I said, you know, you don't know. You really don't know, and you'll never know what it's like to get charged by a sow grizzly at 10 yards, or it's, you know, 38 below zero and you're freezing to death, or you spilled gas on your hands at 40 below and you got blisters, and then you're 1,000 miles from home. And, you know, those are real authentic stories, and they really happened. You know, it wasn't some fake thing.
Yeah. It's so, when I'm telling certain stories, it's like I almost feel the weird question coming, so I feel like I have to almost address it first. My first blacktail deer that I shot this year, it took me a while to work my way down to it because it was pretty steep and it was a bunch of clear cut. So I finally got to it and I arrived like right when a black bear did. Mm-hmm. And it looked right at me and I looked at it and I kind of yelled like in shock and the thing took off. And then it kind of looped around me and then I was just talking to it and it took off. And, you know, to someone who doesn't know any better, they're like, that's irresponsible for you. You should have, you know, just gotten away. I'm like, well, if you grew up in Alaska, you know, you kind of learn bears' temperaments and it always changes, but there's like serious situations and there's not. And the biggest thing was I'm dealing with the black bear. Like if I was up north and it was a grizzly bear, that's a totally different story.
Totally different deal.
I can't even imagine. Right. Have you had an encounter similar to that? I'm sure you have.
Boy.
Yeah, you have. You talked about it a couple in the book.
Yeah, I think that's chapter one in my book. It's a dangerous game. I've had so many encounters. It's not even funny. I mean, seriously. And it's not because... And it's just because of where we were at. It wasn't irresponsible. It wasn't nobody's fault or nothing. I mean, that story, you know, it talks about a friend of mine, a first timer, he was from Arkansas. He's one of my dad's friends. He wanted to come up and moose hunt. That's when moose tags were dime a dozen, which they're not anymore. But anyway, we had a bear come into our camp that night and charge the tent. I mean, I thought it was, and you know, my buddy's scared to death. I mean, absolutely scared to death. And, I know bears and, you know, I'm ready. If he comes, we're going to get him. And, you know, the next morning we wake up and he's got our camp torn to pieces and I had bought a new raft and it was torn to pieces. And I told him, I said, man, we're going to kill that bear. We're going to kill him because he'll be back. He likes this too much. And, sure enough, next day, found him. He found me too at the same time and he charged me and I had a bow in my hand actually at the time and my buddy luckily had a rifle and I said, give me the rifle. I think it was 8 yards or 20. I don't know what it was. I know it was so close. It was slow motion. So that was one instance, but we got the bear. Now, was it the bear? I do not know. Still don't know to this day because we've seen 11 more, I think, and then on that trip. So... You know, that's one instance. And on Kodiak one time, me and my buddy were hunting deer down there. And it's something to watch a 10-foot brown bear come strolling from a half mile away and stop about 30 yards from you and just look at you. I don't care who you are. But, there's been lots of those kinds of instances over time. And, you know, I wouldn't trade any of them for anything. I really wouldn't. They were all special.
Do you get to a point where you're, I don't want to say comfortable because that can't be the right word, but maybe you're less frantic, nervous. You can think maybe a little bit more clearly in those moments when you've had more encounters.
You can. Yeah. You know, Lou and I write about Lou. If it wasn't for Lou, there wouldn't have been no book, but Lou and I hunted together a lot in the last, I don't know, 10 or 12 years that I've known him since he moved up there. But we got to the point, I was telling you about all those bears we have up there, and there's lots of bears. I tell you, if I would have been a smart guy, which I'm not, if I would have been a smart guy back in the day, I would have got a guy's life. Because, guys, there's lots of people that want to hunt bears, and I know it's not for everybody, and a lot of people scoff at it, but my honest opinion, there's too many bears, and that's one of the reasons we got less moose and we got less caribou, and you know, a lot of people think that's nuts, but I think that's a true fact but we got to the point where we were hunting this one stretch of river that we would see, but it wasn't which bear, it wasn't how many bears you would see, it was which one do you want to stalk and hunt or shoot or whatever. I mean, I was seeing like 15 to 20 bears a evening, certain stretches of river. And I'm like, that's crazy. And you would get to the point like, we would set camp and, you know, basically our camp, and there's a few stories in there that I have about, I write about where we would hunt the mornings and hunt the evenings and fish all day. And that was that was almost perfect. And every night we had bears every evening. You know, I'm talking that people think night,
it's not dark. It's, as an Alaskan, you would know this. It's like midnight and it's still daylight outside. And, but you know, we would get, oh, there's a bear in front of our tent. Okay. He's going on. We're just kind of watching him. Oh, wait, here comes another bear across the river. He's chasing fish. And then, oh, look, down there's a sound three cubs. Or up, oh, look at that big boar crossing up north there. Let's go after him. And then, yeah. But, you know, you never want to get too comfortable.
Yeah.
Because one of these times, it'll happen when you don't think it'll happen.
So you got up there a couple of years after Chris McCandless, but you were living in Kotzebue when Timothy Treadwell.
Yeah.
What was kind of, it's obviously, both are tragedies, but it's also, you know, what was kind of the, what was the conversation surrounding that? Or what were you thinking after that happened? Maybe specifically, you know, Treadway.
Yeah. You know, I was up there. That was in the early days. I think that was back in the early 2000, wasn't it? I believe.
Yeah. Treadwell was 2003.
I was going to stick 03, 04. I just thought it was, I don't want to sound, you know, I just thought it was stupid, but you know, those bears, and I've hunted on Kodiak in those days and in that area. I know it's not exactly the same spot, but I've hunted on the same side of that river as he has. You just, that's just irresponsible. You just don't do that. You got to, you know, they look like big old brown pets, but I tell you what, they just, in the blink of an eye, it's all over.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously. I mean, but the McCandless thing, I read the book, I probably read it a lot, you know, because it's good writing, because I think Krakauer is a good writer, but I just thought that was irresponsible. That wasn't smart. I mean, the thing is, the thing that really got me, Jeff, on that book, on that thing, is I think to myself, as an Alaskan, I guess, transplant, long time Alaskan, Arctic Alaskan, I could have saved him. Could have saved that guy if he wanted saved. You know, that's what I, you know, every time I read it or see that movie when it's on, I think, you know, I could have saved that guy. So that's how I look at that.
Yeah. That's such a tough one. It's in the way Krakauer wrote it was, you know, great. And that's why it was such a widely popular book, was that it really, mm-hmm. It sounds like he has something else figured out. Like we all want that, especially when you're 18, 19 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You just want to go. You just want to get out. You're tired of rules. You're tired.
Yeah,
you just want absolute independence. And you know the irony of becoming more dependent upon society once you tried to break free of it. Because then, you know, once he burnt his money, like he was dependent upon people to be generous to him. So like all the mm-hmm. people who were doing the bull that he wanted to get away from, he needs those people now. And it's a tragic story, but there's something that's appealing. It's about finding mm-hmm. kind of that middle zone. And then the thing about Treadwell is, you know, he was doing that for 13 summers. He was
There you go. He had 13 lives.
And then,
isn't that crazy?
The sad thing, this is the last time that, like, he usually left before that. So he left before, like, that last sort of, the bears are really starting to put on the pounds because it's getting mm-hmm. close. And so they're a lot more intolerant at that point. And so that was the first time that he'd stayed until October. And that's when he was attacked. And the sad thing too is also that his terrified girlfriend was with him. And so it wasn't just him,
awful?
It was also his girlfriend.
Yeah. I think bottom line, you got to know when it's time to say when, I think. I mean, I don't know, but yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that there's a responsibility that people have when they're telling Alaska stories? We've talked about, you know, people doing the shows and showing some,
I think so,
whatever.
Yeah.
Is there a responsibility when people come up here to tell it like it is so that people aren't misled?
Oh yeah, I believe it 100%. Tell it like it is. Tell it like it really is, not some, you know, fantasy version of, oh, it's wonderful. It's a wonderful place. Don't get me wrong. I love it. I love everything about it, and I miss it dearly, but it's cruel. It's, you know, nature, Alaska can be. I read a book what did I read for the 40th time? I read a Capstick book. I don't know if everybody knows who Peter Capstick is, but he's a big African writer, and I think he's one of the greatest writers that ever wrote. But he talks about Africa and how he, you know, I like this kind of meat, and I like to eat these kind of dried worms, and I like these kind, I, you know, I, with the tribesmen and the people, and in the end he goes, you know, yeah, I'm African, and even though I don't live here, I'm African. And I think as Alaskans, as an Alaskan writer, or if you write about Alaska, you need to tell it as it is. You need to tell the truth so people, you know, because everybody wants to go to Alaska. I had a guy here, the guy that fixed my heating and air a while ago. He wants to go to Alaska. I said, well, you need to go. I said, you got to go, man. You can't just keep saying you want to go. He goes, but I don't know what, I don't know. Can you go with me? I said, well, I can't go with you, but I can help you. I can tell you how it really is and what you really need to know and what you really need to expect and what, you know, you need to take, blah, 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 blah. He goes, well, that'd be helpful. So I gave him one of my books and he went on his way.
Nice. Perfect. That's so nice to be able to kind of be that ambassador. And it's so fun. I've had a bunch of teaching friends because, you know, there are a lot of people who just can't afford to come up here, you know, and so or they don't know where to start. Like, well, how do I plan? Where do I go? Like, what do I do? And so be able to have friends to come up. And even if it is just, you know, we're going to the river to catch silvers. So they're not getting king salmon in the ocean. They're not getting huge halibut. They're not hunting, but they're just finding that little space that's unoccupied by anybody else. And we're fishing the river and it's wild and something that they've never done before. It's so much fun to see people, and it makes it so much newer for me every time that I'm showing it off again. Cause I think that, oh yeah, yeah. That's that wonderment that I can't have anymore cause I've lived here for so long.
All right. And that's, you know, I feel the same way. You showing it off. Yeah. I loved it when we had people come up, and I had friends come up, and you know, I have had lots of friends come up over the last 20, 30 years, and they still, every time I see them, the conversation always goes back to our time in Alaska. You know, I had a couple of book signings. I've had, a couple, I think, in the last couple of months, down here in the lower 48, a couple of places. And those friends would drive. They drove, some of them lived, you know, a couple hours, 3 hours away, and they would drive to those book signings and sit with me because they had gotten a book already, and just want to converse and talk about that time, and that time that my buddies were cooking bacon in the tent and I come back from hunting caribou and to camp, and they're in there, they don't know any better, and they're in there and they had just seen a sow and two cubs, you know, not a quarter mile from camp, and I scolded them pretty hard. Well, I did more than that, but they never forgot that. But that was their experience. And you know, it's just a joy to, I think it would have been, I think, you know, I hope to go back. I mean, I don't hope. I'm going to go back. I think I'm going to go back this spring, but I hope to go back. And when I do, I hope I get to take friends with me and people I know and people that maybe have never been and want to experience what it really is like. Yeah. So
what is the, like, thing you're going to miss the most? And then what is the hunt you're going to miss the most?
Thing I'm going to miss the most is I'm going to miss the snow. That sounds crazy, doesn't it? I'm going to miss the snow. I really am. I'm going to miss the snow. I'm going to miss the cold because it don't do that down here. I'm going to miss that. I'm going to miss snow machines. I'm going to miss, I don't know. I'm going to miss Halloween in the Arctic. Halloween in the Arctic is, I mean, that don't have anything to do with anything, but I'm going to miss Halloween in the Arctic because as teachers, you know how kids are.
Oh, yeah.
You would get every kid in the community would come to your house. And they would, hey, Mr. Atkins, hey, Mrs. Atkins, because my wife taught. And, you know, after you're there 25 years, it's like second nature. Oh, yeah, I remember when your mom used to come to my door, blah, 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 blah. Actually, we got to the point where it was almost grandkids. But I'm going to miss Halloween in the Arctic. I would say that's it because it's snowing, it's cold, it's dark. And to be honest, it's a joyous time. And I'm going to miss Halloween. So, yeah. The hunt I'm going to miss the most. That's a tough one. That is a tough question there. I would say seeing the big caribou bulls in the tundra with the fall colors. I'm going to miss caribou more than anything. Though the last few years I've taken some during the winter months during subsistence hunts, but I have not, you know, taking one lately, but I'm going to miss caribou. And I love moose meat. Moose meat is my uno number one oh. And, you know, so probably caribou hunting.
Awesome. So, well, thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate your time. Where can people find you? Where can they order the book? All that stuff.
Yeah, you can find me on, I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram, Paul D. Atkins, on Facebook. On Instagram, it's Paul Atkins Outdoors. You can also go to my website, www.paulatkinsoutdoors.com. Best way is just, message me and message me or email me and, we'll get you set up. You can get the book on Amazon. Hopefully I was told it might be in the, Anchorage Airport, maybe at a couple of those places that we're working on that right now. But, if you want a signed copy, give me a call or, email me. I get it right out to you. I've noticed that shipping's a lot faster from here up to there than it is from there down to here.
I bet.
it is crazy. But yeah, you know, I've got some on hand now, but I can always get more, I think. And yeah, I appreciate anybody and everybody that wants a copy and wants to read it, and those that have bought it and those kinds of things, I thank you. So yeah.
Awesome. Well, thanks, man. Appreciate it. Good luck with the weather down there.
Hey, man, Jeff, you have some fun for me up there, man.
Will
do. Catch your fish, hunt some deer. All righty, buddy.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.